From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is away this week. On today's show, a new school board looks to remake itself.
This is an old conversation about how to instill good governance. It's actually a lot of practices that most districts across the nation already engage in.
A city commission considers whether to continue Kansas City's health levy. Plus, a local author introduces the first book of a murder mystery series.
Crime fiction, at its essence, is always about cleaning up messes.
And we check out the guru of line dancing and two-step in KC.
Some people are count people, some people are left, right, left people, and sometimes I'll just tell them and give them an exercise, like bob your head in the car, because rhythm is of the utmost importance in executing the steps.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. I'm back, but Susan Wilson is away this week. The head of Kansas City, Missouri's school board won re-election this week by just a couple hundred write-in votes. The same day results were announced, Eric Leonard West and the three newly elected board members got right down to business at their first meeting. The agenda included a plan to overhaul the structure of the board itself. Now, the recent turmoil brought about by the school district's loss of accreditation might explain why only one of four school board races actually had candidates listed on the ballot. A flurry of write-in candidates later emerged for the three other seats. That's why it took the election board more than a week to count all the votes. Board President Eric Leonard West himself only decided to run for re-election a few weeks ahead of time. He talked about it over a cell phone just before the meeting.
It certainly is not where I plan to be, but I'm honored to serve. I'm ready to serve. I know I'm much better prepared to do so on behalf of the scholars of this district than I was 4 years ago.
Seven of the nine members on the new board were endorsed by West or by the organization he helped found, Kansas Cityans United for Educational Achievement. Among the new ones are parent Marisol Montero, who won in the third subdistrict, and John Heil, executive director of Big Brothers Big Sisters. Heil defeated incumbent Arthur Benson in the first. The fourth winner, not part of that slate, was former principal Curtis Rogers in the fifth. Parent leader Jamika Kendrick says she thinks this board will be united.
What I do want or expect is that there will be more intentional engagement of the community when major decisions are made, like recently the superintendent decision.
What Kendricks is referring to is that the night before the election, the school board announced that interim superintendent Steve Green's contract would be made permanent. At the new board's first meeting on Wednesday night, Eric Leonard West was elected chair again and Crispin Rea vice chair. And immediately, West introduced a plan to address some of the criticism of the board that has accompanied the district's loss of accreditation.
This is an old conversation about how to instill good governance. It's actually a lot of practices that most districts across the nation already engaged in, and we're just looking to play catch-up.
The plan would create a three-member advisory board appointed by the mayor to work alongside the elected board. The proposal would also call for new state legislation to reduce the number of board members from 9 to 7, one from each sub-district, but all elected at large. And it would move the school board elections from April to August in the hopes of getting better turnout. Bill Eddy is a former board member and former dean of the Black School of Business and Public Administration at UMKC. He's now part of a group that monitors the board and is advocating for an alternative form of governance.
My perception of the board and the perception of our organization, Do the Right Thing for Kids, has been that this board is well-intentioned. It's fairly benign in terms of its influence on the administration, but we have felt like a major turnaround effort is needed if this district is going to be saved and the kids are going to be educated in the way they ought to be.
Eddy supports state legislation that would immediately give the state the authority to step in and appoint an advisory board to replace the elected board. It's one of the more likely possibilities among a number of bills dealing with the Kansas City School District, including one that would just turn over schools to surrounding districts. School board supporters hope to convince the Missouri Department of Elementary and Secondary Education to hold off on a takeover. Board President Eric Leonard West cites the slew of write-in candidates who eventually ran for election and this new proposal to remake the board.
What's critical is that the plan for restoring achievement doesn't change. We have a plan in place. DESE signed off on it. Our community wrote it. But we need a stronger governance system to help continue to shepherd it. That's what this conversation is about, and I think it'll be a very productive one.
On Thursday evening, the board will host a community meeting at Manual Tech High School to discuss the newest proposal. They plan to vote on it on April 25th. Kansas City residents have long financed health services for indigent patients through a property tax. Last year, that tax brought in nearly $50 million. Part of the tax is temporary, though. And as KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, a new commission appointed by the mayor is taking a hard look at whether it should continue.
Kansas Cityans have been subsidizing public health, ambulance, and healthcare services in the region for more than half a century. But those funds have been under greater stress in recent years. John Bluford, CEO of Truman Medical Centers, the once city-owned hospital, says for one, the economy tanked in 2008, leaving more people without health insurance and resources to get care.
And the second is a significant change in eligibility requirements for Medicaid here, which has, in effect, eliminated a lot of people off of the Medicaid rolls.
Bluford says these two things have brought in a lot more people who are unable to pay for their care to the hospital and neighborhood clinics. At the same time, the whole region is in a pinch for resources. During his State of the City speech last month, Kansas City Mayor Sly James pointed to the city's $600 million in deferred maintenance. The fire department is taking cuts. And with so many taxes dedicated to specific projects like public safety, James said all must be reviewed right now to ensure money is going where it's needed most.
I've lived in Kansas City a long time, and I can tell you that we seldom prepare for the loss of tax revenues. Instead, we work feverishly at the end of the time when they're about to expire to make sure that they're renewed. I'm a Marine, and we used to call that gunpoint diplomacy. That philosophy has created a jumble mess of revenue streams for which we are constantly going back to our voters seeking renewal.
That includes a specific tax for health services. The health levy, as it's called, has two main funding streams. One is a permanent property tax that brings in around $30 million a year. The other is a temporary property tax increase that voters approved in 2005. That portion brings in another $15 million or so dollars annually, but it expires in 2 years.
You know, the question, a temporary levy, should it be renewed?
Local businesswoman Susan Stanton is head of the Citizens Commission on Municipal Revenue. Mayor James recently revived the commission after it was inactive for decades and charged the group with studying Kansas City's revenue needs. The group recently pressed area health leaders on the health levy. Truman CEO John Bluford told them the funds are critical to the hospital. Truman gets about half of what the entire health levy brings in, about $25 million. But he says last year, the hospital provided around $60 million in care to more than 20,000 Kansas City residents who were unable to pay. Municipal Revenue Commission member Tim Crystal says the group isn't debating whether the care these health providers deliver is important, but rather whether the city should be financing so much of it.
If they promised the voters in 2005 that it would be temporary, what things made it temporary, and what things did they say they needed to study and or consider during that period, and how well have they studied them?
The federal health law is also starting to complicate this discussion, with commission members pointing out that if the Supreme Court upholds the law, thousands of more people will gain coverage. But proponents of renewing the health levy in some form, like Health Department Director Dr. Rex Archer, say an expansion in coverage under the health law will take years and won't be in place by the time the health levy sunsets. Dr. Archer says in the meantime, people, the local economy, wind up losing if the city scales back health funding. Private insurance rates go up as the cost of providing that care shifts. Dr. Archer says looking to the state isn't an option either. Its funding for health has been declining for decades.
20 years ago, Missouri was in the middle of the pack of states in regards to the health status of the population of the state. We're now down to 40th and continuing to slide. Unless Kansas City wants to have the health status of the rest of the state, we have to continue to invest.
Dr. Archer says in some ways, Kansas City's arrangement with Truman and other health centers is unique. Neither Wyandotte County nor St. Louis has an equivalent tax. A spokesperson with the Missouri Hospital Association says hospitals in Missouri that have traditionally been public have been changing their models, and many are relying more and more on patient revenue as opposed to public funds. But Bruce Siegel, president of the National Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems, says many cities are active in supporting local health services.
It is very common to have the local county or local city funding the safety net provider in a community. We really see it from coast to coast.
But Siegel says with more and more cities facing growing financial pressure and with possible changes coming under the federal health law, places across the country are engaging in debates and conversations similar to what's happening in Kansas City. The Citizens Commission on Municipal Revenue plans to issue recommendations on the health levy and other city revenue streams next month. From there, the city council and residents will have about a year and a half to figure out whether or not to put that tax up for renewal. Reporting for Casey Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
Many of the city's fountains were turned on this past Tuesday morning after the 39th annual celebration of Fountain Day at the Marlboro Fountain at 79th and Paseo. The excitement continued a few miles north, where KCR's Tamika Weatherspoon talked with fountaingoers in the plaza area.
My name's Jim Pettit. I'm a local plaza street musician. Well, I like to come down the plaza, and I like to play where nobody else is playing. There's not too many musicians down here today, and this looked like a good place. I love playing. It's one of my favorite places.
I literally screamed as I was crossing the street and saw that it was on, so I'm very happy. I love fountains and water.
Which one is your favorite fountain?
I would say that currently this one is my favorite fountain.
Any particular reason?
It's big and it's beautiful, and my daughter likes it.
And what's your name?
Anastasia Hischer.
And who is this?
That is my daughter, Arabella.
She's shy. She's running away.
She is.
My baby girl likes water. She thought we were coming to swim. I said, we're not coming to swim. We're just coming to look at the pretty fountain in the water.
So what's your name?
Dustin.
And what's your name? Nina. How old are you?
Two.
Do you like the fountain?
Yeah. Look at those young boys.
Is it pretty, Lena?
Look at those little boys.
And you see the horses and the bear.
The doe is in the bear. Mm-hmm. And the doe is in the bear.
KCUR's Tamika Weatherspoon brought us that audio postcard from Fountain Day on the plaza. Coming up, the launch of a new mystery series based here in Kansas City. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is out this week. Murder Mystery Fans, a new series of police crime novels, launches next week, starring the tough but sensitive Skeet Banyan. She's a former KCPD homicide detective who wanted to get away by becoming the police chief on a small-town college campus. Skeet is the creation of local author Linda Rodriguez, who won a national competition with this first novel. It's now being published by St. Martin's Press and has already been recommended as a must-read for this month by Barnes & Noble's mystery editor. Rodriguez officially launches the book at the Kansas City Public Library on April 24th, but she joins us now in studio to talk about Every Last Secret, which merges the mystery genre with some witty observations about life in a college town. Thanks for coming in, Linda.
Well, thank you for having me, Sylvia.
It's nice to have you back.
It's lovely to be back.
With a new book.
Yes.
And so I was hoping we'd just start out with a reading so people could get a little bit of a taste of your new mystery. Do you need to set up the section that you're going to read?
There has been a murder, and the murder weapon is missing. They know it's something large and chunky. And Skeet Banyan is the protagonist, who is the chief of police of a small-town campus police force. And she is going out and trying to, you know, question suspects. And a friend of hers, kind of kooky friend, has said that she knows something about this. So she's gone to talk to her friend, who formerly was a well-known model in Kansas City, who went to California, failed, and had an enlightening, and came back as a New Age bookstore owner and guru. I hung up and headed for the town square and Mother Earth Books with a lighter heart. Maybe this murderer would turn out to be an outsider after all, someone from the underbelly of Kansas City. Maybe the chancellor would get his wish. As I parked in the town square, the final wisps of cloud sailed east and the full sun burst forth. The day was looking up. I entered the bookstore accompanied by the jingle of a bell. The air smelled of sweet herbal incense. A bulky wooden counter with a cash register, vacant except for a massive long-haired cat with gray and white stripes, stood in the middle of the store. I walked over and petted the cat. "Hey, Carnunos, where's your mom?" He stretched his neck to put his head more fully within my caress. "She's supposed to be meeting me, not to mention that anyone could rip off the whole store right now." The cat was content to stay as we were forever. I, however, had moved into that state of restless energy that fed my investigations and kept me constantly on the move, trying to add to the pool of information until I could build the case. I gave Carnunos one last pat, then headed for the back of the store. Mother Earth Books was painted in warm, vibrant reds and golds to contrast with dark walnut shelves and counters. High walls above the shelving held richly colored ethnic wall hangings and rugs. Miriam's contribution to the decor lay in the large crystals, amethyst, malachite, rose quartz, I couldn't remember all the names, that sat on various tables and shelves. When I'd first gone to the store, I'd told Miriam she was asking for theft by leaving the semi-precious gems lying around so freely. She'd replied confidently that her crystals would never allow themselves to be stolen. I thought she was nuts, but none of the stones ever turned up missing. I didn't really like to think about it. I called out softly for Miriam, not wanting to disturb the readers. Just before I reached the back wall, a door opened and Miriam stepped out with an armload of books. "Is it that late? Have you been waiting very long?" "Not very, but people could have been stealing from you. You shouldn't leave things unsupervised." Miriam laughed her musical, practiced laugh. "No one could steal from us. I've put strong mystical protections all around the store. We're absolutely safe." I rolled my eyes. "I think an alarm system and an alert staff would be more secure." "You are so tied to this material plane. When are you going to learn to let loose of that tight hold on physicality and let your spirit fly free?" Miriam set the books on the counter and picked up the cat. "Be like Carnunos, absorbed in the sheer joy of being. He's a very metaphysical cat, aren't you, boy?" I laughed. "He looks pretty absorbed in physicality to me. He must weigh 25 pounds. You need to put him on a diet." She set him on the counter. "He spends most of his day meditating. He's really quite spiritual. Cats are very evolved beings, of course, but Carnunos is especially highly developed." "It's his appetite that's highly developed." I smoothed down the long hair on the cat's back. "Isn't that right, you pretty pig?" "I think he eats so much in order to keep himself grounded while his soul is flying." Miriam was quite serious. "You're so tied to the physical realm that you can't see it." I shook my head again. It's that physical realm I've come to see you about.
And it's all part of the investigation of a murder that happened on campus. And let's set up the plot of Every Last Secret a little bit more. It's about Skeet Banyan, a KCPD homicide detective who leaves the force to become chief of campus police in a college town just outside of Kansas City for change of pace. And a month after she arrives, 6 months after she arrives, I should say, there's a murder on campus.
It's the chief editor, editor-in-chief of the campus newspaper, who has been killed. And as Skeet begins the investigation, she finds that he has had his fingers in all kinds of dirty little pies. And those threads lead into the town, into the city, and into the highest levels of the campus administration. The chancellor, of course, just wants her to sweep everything under the rug because they're in the middle of a capital campaign. And Skeet refuses to do this. She can't actually. There's a federal law that says you can't, and she throws that back in his face.
And you mentioned that the murder victim had his hands in all sorts of dirty little pies,
yes,
which perhaps people wouldn't expect would exist on a college campus in a small, pristine college town.
I recently did a guest blog on one of the big mystery group blogs called Jungle Red Riders. And I wrote about that, and this was right after the Sandusky stuff had come out. And I wrote a guest blog about campus crime, and people were just amazed at the kinds of crimes that go on campus and have been going on for a long time. But, you know, they're often larger than many small towns, and they have this population that's mostly in the age group when people are going to act out, when they're going to do risky things they haven't done before, and when they haven't quite developed their full sense of good judgment.
Interesting, because the book isn't obviously about that issue, but it makes me wonder, how much were you thinking about that when you decided to set the mystery on a college campus?
Well, I wanted to set it on a college campus because I know college campuses. In my previous career, I was on a college campus as an administrator for a long time. And also because I wanted to use a female campus police chief. I didn't want to do an urban police procedural just in the building with the police force, but I wanted a heroine who had a reason to investigate crimes. She wasn't just nosy, who also was capable in terms of physical combat, in terms of using a weapon and carrying a weapon, and would have a reason for that. And I knew about campus police forces, so that all worked together. I made up a little town and a little college to put it in right outside of Kansas City, because since I had worked in a Kansas City university for many years, I did not want people thinking, oh, did that crime really happen at that university?
And people here in Kansas City might be wondering, it's supposed to be 12 miles outside of Kansas City, trying to figure out which campus it is and which little college town.
It's actually, I made this town up. It sits in location about where Riverside is. It's based a lot on Parkville, Lawrence, and Liberty. The college physically is based a lot on Park College because it's got this beautiful scenic campus. And in actuality, in the way the college is run and the people going on, it's based on a lot of universities all around the Kansas City area.
And the book, of course, jumps full on into this world of academic personalities and politics. And Skeet Banyan observes pretty early on that academia has a stricter hierarchy than the police.
Well, the police is a paramilitary organization, and so they have this very strong hierarchy. But in academia, and when I said that, Skeet's talking about the wife of a dean of the business school, and the dean divorced her and married one of his students. And the wife, to support her children, took a job as a high-level administrative person, the executive assistant to another dean. But that classed her as non-faculty or faculty wife. That put her over in the staff side. A lot of faculty regard those jobs as just clerical, no matter how high-level they are. So she dropped immediately out of all of her friends on the faculty and their wives. She dropped immediately out of their social viewpoint.
Now, how did the idea of writing a mystery come up? This is your first.
I've been a poet for years, but I always wanted to write a novel. I set up this town and this character. I wanted to write a book about her. And because of the kind of character she was, a mystery seemed to be natural.
Was she a police officer from the beginning?
Yes, yes. She was. I had known a woman who bears no resemblance to anyone in this book. I had known a woman who had once been the highest ranking female police officer in the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. She's since retired. And I thought if you took that kind of a woman and had her leave that kind of promising career, what could cause that? And immediately I came up with Skeet Banyan's ex-cop father who had to retire in disgrace because he was a drunk and because they were claiming that he was dishonest, and her still a cop ex-husband who's charming and manipulative and possessive and does not want to let Skeet go, even though they've been divorced for several years. And I thought she will go to flee them and to flee the reputation that her father has developed.
And Skeet Banyan's half-Cherokee background influences her in her police work and in her life.
This is the first in a series of books about Skeet. And through the course of this series, Skeet is going to come more and more to accept her Cherokee heritage. At the beginning in this first book, her grandmother, who helped to raise her, has had a huge influence on her. And Skeet is always thinking of what Gran would say and what Gran would do. It's not like she denies it, but she doesn't see herself as living as Cherokee. And as we move through the series, we're going to see more and more. Skeet's a very kind of closed person at the beginning of this book, and the book is going to crack her open, and each story after this is going to crack her a little further open and let more people into her life.
What surprised you about this world that Skeet Banyan inhabits, either in your research or in your own writing, when you sort of discovered the characters and the stories as you were writing?
That's the fun part of writing a novel, I think, is that the characters grow on you in ways you never imagined, and the world just opens out for you. When I started the book, I knew what the initial crime would be, and I didn't really know yet who had done it. And I knew something would have to happen in the course of this investigation to really crack Skeet open somehow. And I didn't know exactly what it was going to be. And then along came this young teenage boy who walks Skeet's dog, who winds up, through no fault of his own, caught up in all kinds of tragedy and violence. And I wasn't expecting that. And when I went with that, it just went to wonderful places that I hadn't meant to go. There are people who outline murder mysteries, and there are people who write it the way I did, with an idea of what the murder is and not really knowing who yet among all these possibles did it. And we call ourselves the plotters and pantsers, which is fly by the seat of your pants. And
which are you?
I'm more of a pantser. Though since I'm going to have to be doing at least one book a year now, I'm going to have to start doing some kind of plotting, because I've done the second one and turned it in, and I need to start on the third one. And I think, well, I need to know a little bit more ahead of time.
I wonder, just more broadly, as someone who's been an advocate of women writers for a long time, what do you think about the role of women in this police mystery genre? I think there's quite a few that have been really successful. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I'm a member of an organization called Sisters in Crime, which actually was founded in this area. Its home base is Lawrence, Kansas, and the great writer Sarah Paretsky and Nancy Picard and a couple of others were the founders. And of course, Nancy lives in Kansas City, and Sarah Paretsky was originally from Lawrence. And Sisters in Crime was founded, gosh, it's 25 or 30 years ago now, to address the fact that women crime writers were not getting the reviews, they were not being published anywhere near proportion to their numbers, and the awards. And the idea was, and they still monitor reviews and things like that, and those things have changed for the better tremendously, and it's opened a lot of doors for women in crime fiction. Some of the most successful and big bestsellers in crime fiction right now are women. But I think it's a natural for women because, number one, the readership of mysteries and thrillers is overwhelmingly female. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that, but it's mostly women buying those books. Also because crime fiction, at its essence, is always about cleaning up messes, restoring order when it's been broken and thrown into chaos, making things right again. And this is something women know a lot about.
There's going to be a whole series of Skeet Banyan books. How many are there?
I would envision it, if all goes well, going, you know, 6 or 7 books at least until I get tired of Skeet. I have another series I'd actually like to write that my agent and editor are interested in that would be set directly in Kansas City in the West Side Latino community. So we'll see how things play out with Skeet first. I have to build an audience before I launch another series.
Great. Well, Linda Rodriguez is the author of Every Last Secret, the first in a series of mystery novels. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Sylvia.
Linda Rodriguez will be discussing her new mystery novel, Every Last Secret, on Tuesday, April 24th at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. The 4-day William Inge Theater Festival in Independence, Kansas, includes dozens of plays, readings, and workshops. And it always concludes with a salute to a particular playwright or composer. Past honorees have included Arthur Miller, Edward Albee, and Stephen Sondheim. Joining that list this year will be David Henry Hwang, whose body of work has been informed by his Asian American heritage. KCUR's Steve Walker has more.
Every April for 31 years, the quaint town of Independence, Kansas, has become flooded with theater artists and theater lovers for the William Inge Theater Festival. And part of the appeal is its yearly salute to a noted playwright or composer. Festival director Peter Ellenstein explains how various parties came to select this year's honoree, David Henry Hwang.
The guest artists and members of our National Advisory Board get together and have knockdown, drag-out fights about who should be given the award the following year. And David has been appearing on the list quite regularly for the last few years. The wonderful thing about this award is that as you do the research on it, you find out you didn't realize just how deep and broad their area of work has been.
Interviewed from his home in New York City, David Henry Hwang says he is sincerely appreciative, yet a little surprised by the honor.
I was pretty shocked because I didn't know if I had enough of a body of work to be considered for something as kind of iconic as the Inge Award. And since, you know, a lot of my work has to do with East-West issues and kind of East Asian things, you know, did they want to bring that many East Asian actors in? As the Brits say, I was kind of gobsmacked. I was shocked in a good way that they would think of my work in my body of work in that vein.
Hwang is perhaps best known for his Tony Award-winning play, M. Butterfly, the provocative story of a French diplomat who falls in love with a male opera singer posing as a woman. He's juggled other plays, like last year's critically acclaimed Chinglish, with work on operas, screenplays, and musicals. For example, he wrote the book for the smash Elton John Tim Rice version of Aida. I asked Hwang if he deliberately set out to bring Asian stories and characters to the masses, or just write compelling narratives that happen to have Asian influences.
It's been generally trying to tell the best stories I can, and I seem to be attracted to these East-West subjects. That said, I mean, there was probably a period, not when I first started writing, but when I first started you know, having work produced and getting known a little, where I sort of embraced the banner of being somebody who was bringing Asian American theater to New York in the mainstream. But, you know, that was maybe 3 or 4 years, and then I kind of got tired of that as being my raison d'etre.
While his work has naturally employed many Asian actors, the bigger picture tells a discouraging tale. A recent study by the Asian American Performers Action Coalition examined 400 plays produced in New York over the past 5 years. It found that while actors of color increased from 14% to 22%, Caucasian actors played 80% of the roles. Wong moderated a panel about the issue in February and notes that roles for Asian Americans actually decreased.
If you bring up statistics like this, I think people are open to and surprised to, you know, open to receiving them and surprised at what they imply. Number one, I have been seeing more Asian actors. There just is a bigger pool out there every year, and they're better trained, and so that's, you know, that's very hopeful. And really, what a lot of the actors were arguing for in this case is just the ability to go in and audition for roles that aren't specifically Asian. And you know, if it's the friend or, you know, something that's not where the race isn't specified, and it could just be anybody, then why shouldn't they get to audition for it too?
Those statistics should see an upswing next season. New York Signature Theater has named David Henry Wong their year-long resident playwright and will stage a series of his plays. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
After the break, we stop in on a line dancing class at Southeast Community Center. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson is away today. In area news this week, OSHA levied a heavy fine over an Atchison grain elevator explosion. Childcare, not services to the blind, took the big hit in the latest Missouri budget proposal. And the wait for Kansas City school board election results finally ended. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
When three races have only write-in candidates, the counting takes a while. And more than a week after Kansas City's school board election, the remaining three winners were announced. Curtis Rogers, Marisol Montero, and incumbent President Eric Leonard West, who was already promoting teamwork.
A 9-member team of elected officials is not a great place, you know, for, you know, any diehard ideologies to thrive.
As the board struggled with regaining district accreditation and the threat of a state takeover, a new proposal emerged to trim the board to 7 members and add the mayor in an advisory capacity. The Missouri Senate Appropriations Committee endorsed a budget for next year that does not include the governor's cuts to higher education and drastically reduces the cuts the House would have made to a program for blind Missourians. But it includes big cuts to child care programs, Medicaid, and prison meal budgets. Budget Chair Kurt Schaefer said the cuts had to be made.
This committee is still responsible for delivering a balanced budget.
Schaefer said it's doubtful that legislators will pass a tax amnesty bill to bring in more revenue, and nobody wants to talk about raising taxes, not even on tobacco. The Missouri House passed another work comp provision bill with a provision from a bill the governor vetoed last month. It would make occupational disorders strictly the province of work comp, not the courts. Kevin McManus explained why Democrats object to that.
That compensation is severely limited in terms of death benefits. It really amounts to almost a burial fee.
The House also passed a resolution changing ballot language that a court struck down on a voter photo ID constitutional amendment. Meanwhile, former Missouri Governor Roger Wilson pled guilty to charges of misappropriating $5,000 from a state-related work comp insurance company and laundering it through a law firm before it ended up as a contribution to the Democratic Party. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback began the reorganization of state agencies involved in Medicaid in preparation for his plan to hire private contractors to manage the program this summer. Brownback also reassured the public.
We are not cutting anybody off of Medicaid. We are not cutting any services currently provided under Medicaid. And we are not cutting providers.
Kansas Democrats remained skeptical but don't have the votes to stop the privatization. New hope for the life of the 50-plus-year-old Antioch Shopping Center in Kansas City's Northland got a shot in the arm when the city council approved the latest developer's proposal for tax increment financing. Councilman Dick Davis said it was past time to turn the crumbling center around.
The old Antioch Shopping Center has been an embarrassment for our district, been in a bad state of decay.
The nearly $60 million deal involves city-issued bonds, a TIF, and a super TIF. And OSHA slapped $400,000 in fines on Kansas City's Bartlett Grain over the Atchison grain elevator explosion last fall that took six lives. The agency said the company was guilty of willful violations of known safety risks. Bartlett officials denied that and said they will contest the fines. This is KCUR.
When it comes to line dancing, most people think of country western dances like Boot Scoot and Boogie. But in African-American communities all over the country, soul line dancing is everywhere, at wedding and retirement receptions, nightclubs and parties. And here in KC, the Kansas City Two-Step, a couples dance, is also wildly popular. And we have our own line and step dancing guru, Dee Barker. She's a software engineer by day, and in the evening teaches line dancing and two-step at the Southeast Community Center. KC Current's Susan Wilson stopped by recently to check it out.
It's an unseasonably warm Thursday night in late March, and the parking lot is packed. The brightly lit Southeast Community Center is abuzz with activity. People are exercising, attending classes, and shooting hoops. But one class stands out. The music is bumping in Dee Barker's line dancing and step class. Dee Barker, a petite pecan brown woman with an afro, calls out the line dance moves. Women of all ages execute a complicated series of steps with gusto. The energy is high, and a crowd gathers outside of the open window to observe the action. Apparently, the class participants attend faithfully, although there are a few first-timers here tonight. During breaks, I ask the women, what has them hooked on line dancing? And what does the dance form mean in the African-American community?
Hello, I'm Yvette. A lot of our culture is based on dance. That's how we celebrate. That's how we praise. That's how we worship. That's how we almost do everything. I mean, some of us even dance while we're cleaning up the house. I mean, dance is just huge for the African-American culture.
It reminds me of just the respect that our ancestors have given to us back in the past through dance and music and song, and to be able to get together without there being any type of competitions or anything, just get together and dance just for the respect of love and just coming together as one. It's a beautiful thing. And it's not even an African-American thing. It's like a culture thing, because you have Caucasians, you have blacks, you have men, you have women, you have kids. Everyone's doing it. And you're just having so much fun.
Hi, my name is Sonia.
So when you're out at clubs or at a wedding, what does line dancing do for you?
Well, a lot of times, I'm a single person. So usually, a lot of times I'm by myself. And line dance gives a good opportunity for a group event for everybody to get in and start having fun without having to worry about having a partner or anything. So, you know, it can be just self-motivating.
I'm Shakita.
And how long have you been coming to the class?
This is my first day.
Really? Mm-hmm. What made you come here?
I just like line dancing, and I'm too scared to do it in front of everybody, so I figured maybe I could learn here.
Ah, so once you've learned, where do you hope to use it?
I guess at the club.
At the club?
Yeah.
Okay, the name of this dance is Show Up. The name of the song is Coming Up. It came from
Say, it's a St. Louis dance from STL Slideshow. Stephanie Crusoe is the choreographer.
Later, the class shifts into a second phase, the stepping portion. Men arrive, and the class swells to over 20 people. Participants find a partner and begin doing a rhythmic and sensual couples dance with fancy footwork, swings, and turns. I ask participants how they would describe stepping and why they love it so much.
Oh, stepping is the motion and the rhythm of two people in synchronization. That's what stepping is.
Shannon Thompson, just kind of being in sync with that young lady while the music is going and y'all just got a vibe going, looking good, you know.
I'm Grady Bell. It's poetry in motion with bodies, you know what I'm saying?
My name is Philip Eugene Gibbs. How would I describe 2-7? It's best dance in the world.
Dee has been dubbed Kansas City's queen of line dancing and step instruction. She teaches a number of classes around town and participates in competitions in other states with her troupe D Unit, as well as the KC Two-Step and Sliders. I wondered, how did Dee Barker become so passionate about line dancing and stepping? And what's happening on Kansas City's line dancing scene? How have these dance forms developed a uniquely Kansas City style? I talked to Dee about these questions and more.
I started dancing, I was the baby of 5 girls. And by the time my mom was pregnant, the 5th time, my dad just knew I was going to be a boy. I wasn't. So he took me under his wing and made me do fishing and sports and enrolled me in dancing and all that. And when he came home from his night outings, he would wake me up to dance for his friends. So I just learned, and they would pay me to dance. They would give me little dollars to dance, and then they call me. I wouldn't take change. You know how you give kids change for dancing? I wouldn't take change, because they start calling me Buck Benny. And then they start singing the song, Buck Benny, don't take no pennies.
Have you ever met anybody you couldn't teach to line dance?
Well, there's a lot of people that, even though they're Black, African-American, they don't have rhythm, you know, so that's a myth. So some people I look at, are you one of us? So I just work with them. I have to find their niche. What works, some people are count people. Some people are left, right, left people. And sometimes I'll just tell them, I give them an exercise, like bob your head in the car. Just bob your head in the car, because rhythm is of the utmost importance in executing the steps. You got to have that rhythm, that timing with your head bobbing and your finger snapping. So
what are the other elements that people need to learn in order to do line dancing well?
Besides the rhythm, how to feel the song, how to, you know, I create dances, I'm a choreographer, and in order for me to do that, it has to be an R&B funk beat, and it has to move me, you know, it has to inspire me. So, you know, if they just, you know, hear some music that they like, and it's half the battle, you know, as far as that you like and you can hone into the beat and the rhythm of it, and you've got that step and that groove and that vibe, and then, you know, just learn the steps, and it's all uphill from there.
So you try to get people to get beyond the electric slide, the Cupid shuffle, the wobble.
So offended when people do the Cupid shuffle and the wobble. I mean, I like those dances and all that, but we need to put those in our database and add more to them.
Right.
Yeah.
You feeling good? Let me say all right, all right. And what up? All right. Pooh Bear, I'm feeling good, so I'm saying myself. All right, all right. Claudia. All right. How you gonna do this?
That was Dee Barker, a software engineer and instructor of line and step dancing at the Southeast Community Center, among other places. She is hosting an event called IDWD, short for I Dance with Dee, celebrating 12 years of teaching in Kansas City on April 27th and 28th. See pictures of the class on our website at kcur.org. Make sure you get to it, everything that you ever want, every tone that you've ever owned. Not to make it hard to respect, just really, 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 really hard to impress. It's a whole wide world for you to go and get your hands on. Until then, just come and get your dance on now.
You must.
misunderstood. Never had money, or you're living good. If you're from the burbs, if you're in the hood, recognize where we come from. In my day, man, I did a little something, something. They like, how come you don't rap that? Cause that's a backtrack, and I ain't trying to backpack. I'm only moving forward, homie, that's that. Direction, a lot of shoulders lack that. I'm just trying to give it to them like sat-nav. Now I know I'm gonna make it like a fat rat. That's cool, as long as he don't trap crack. Graduate from school, and still let his pants sag. Never catch a case, know how to let his cash stack. Welcome to the map, go anyway, tap back.
Thanks for tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org. Sign up for our podcast there or find us on iTunes. We love your feedback and ideas for future shows. Just contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at Casey Currents. Alex Smith is our assistant producer. Carrie Coogan is our intern. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Susan Wilson will be back here with me next week. I'ma try your eyes, just to let you know.